everyone, and welcome to the Research VR podcast. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and today, actually, let's do that one more time. I always miss the tagline. Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, the podcast about the science and design of virtual reality. Today, we have a special new guest. His name is Nick Liewendach, the founder of 3D Scan Expert, who is a expert at 3D capture technologies and a consultant. Hi, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show. And of course, our usual co-host, Peter Lekoff. Hi, Peter.
Well, hello, everyone who's tuning in.
So today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics. If you've heard any of the previous episodes, this topic keeps coming up because it's something I'm very involved in. And it has to do with volumetric and photogrammetry and LiDAR capture. So basically anything that has to do with capturing the real world in full 3D and the various applications of that. And I think there's no better person to have on the show than someone that runs a company called 3D Scan Expert. And you deal a lot with these technologies. So actually, let's start with an overview of what are we talking about when we talk about 3D capture technology?
Yeah, what I try to categorize 3D scanning into a few main technologies. The one I started with 2.5 years ago was what I call sensor scanning. So using depth sensors like the structure sensor, Intel RealSense, Orbex sensors, and all kinds of portable depth sensors for 3D scanning, while they're actually not totally marketed at that purpose because they're marketed at tracking and stuff like that. So that's one thing, depth sensor scanning. Then you have the more professional 3D scanning equipment, like desktop 3D scanners that are usually like structured light scanners with a turntable and a tripod that you can use to scan small to medium objects. Then there are these handheld scanners that you can walk around with freely and capture stuff of all kinds of sizes. Then I have a category of photogrammetry that isn't 3D scanning, but a form of 3D capture that uses 2D images and special software to generate 3D models. And most recently, I've added a new category to the list that covers everything on smartphones. So mobile 3D scanning, if you want. And that can be everything, right? That can be photogrammetry-ish or AR-assisted stuff or depth sensors built into the latest iPhone. Mm-hmm. So those are the things I focus at. People often ask about laser scanning because I don't really cover laser scanning at all. And I get a lot of questions about when are you going to test this scanner or that scanner, and either LiDAR scanners or handheld laser scanners, because I tend to test a lot of structured light stuff. But my criterion for testing stuff is that I need something to be able to capture color. And
To get an overview, I guess, you clearly, like, there's multiple forms and different technologies that get used to capture things in their full 3D form. So you're talking about everything from small objects, right? Let's say either they're sculptures or action figures to, mugs, cups. And if we go a little bit bigger into scanning people, like actual 3D humans, and then bigger than that into capturing interiors of rooms, of houses, of buildings. Yeah. And then the bigger scale of that is actual buildings, like from the exterior and perhaps the street itself, and even like the city, to the biggest form. So all of this obviously like intersects with a lot of different industries. And so what are the main, I guess, with some of your clients and with some of the projects that you work on, what are the main industries do you see already this technology being very relevant to?
The thing I try to focus on is everything except for engineering stuff and like construction stuff.
So what does that everything mean?
Yeah, it can be the most exciting things essentially are the things we haven't even thought of. The cool thing about doing this work is that I get questions every day from people that want to use 3D capture for purposes that only they can think of, because that's their area of expertise, that is their world. And it's not suitable for everything, but it's cool to realize now that 3D capture is in people's mind as a possible tool in a toolbox for creating content.
And why do you actually exclude construction and industry from your clients?
I think it has to do with my background. A lot of people I meet in 3D scanning have technical backgrounds and engineering backgrounds, and I myself have a creative background. I started researching 3D capture and 3D scanning because I wanted to use it in my 3D animation work, because that's my background. I've worked as a 3D designer and motion designer for the past 11 years.
Okay.
So that's my background, and I want to do all kinds of stuff with 3D scanning. And when I started searching for 3D scanning, there was a lot of coverage about the metrology aspects of it, right? Like the purely measurement use cases, like backwards engineering or scanning build sites. And there was a lot of information out there. So I started to work on a niche within a niche.
Mm-hmm.
That was writing about new, exciting, and innovative ways to use 3D scanning, where there wasn't enough content written about.
Yeah.
What year, or around what year did you start the 3D scanning expert, the consultancy, and what technologies existed around that time?
So people think I've been doing this for like decades, but actually I've been doing this for, I think, in total, the last 3 years. It actually started when I got myself a structure sensor just to experiment with, and discovered like, hey, I can use this in my creative projects. And but I found the quality a bit on the low side, so I wanted to know what more there was. And I have been using like the free apps that were available at that time, like 123D Catch from Autodesk, that has been pulled for mysterious reasons. But I was testing with those very approachable ways of 3D capture, but I wanted more.
Right.
So that's why I started requesting all kinds of equipment to test, and I started writing about it.
So could you describe one of your work days or one of your clients or one of your typical exploration process? So does it start with a creative idea and you search for hardware, and then you search for people who will be benefiting from it, or how does it work?
I work for both sides of the spectrum. Essentially, I get hired by companies or individuals or schools or whatever that want to use 3D capture to enhance their product or workflow or whatever they want. On the other side, I give information to developers of 3D capture software or manufacturers of 3D capture hardware, because I am very close to their target audience, especially for manufacturers that have been out there for a while, that have been focusing on the metrology aspects and that are now seeing that there is a wider audience. I get in contact with them to help them go for that side.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also mention that your blog is probably one of the more informative pieces of like information people can stumble upon, where you do a lot of side-by-side analyses of, like, let's say the photogrammetry, the major photogrammetry software, the Reality Capture, Agisoft Photoscan versus like 3DF Zephyr. I think it's probably one of the most like deeper forms of like technical information you could read as for someone that's getting into it. And you also do a lot of reviews of the mobile apps that do, you know, the pseudo photogrammetry things. And so I think, if there's any kind of media organization or blog that goes very deep about these forms of technology, I would probably say you're at the top of that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it's important to do comparisons, because that's usually the first thing that people ask me, like, should I use this or that or that? And what it comes back to is that the question is easier than the answer, because the thing that excites me about 3D capture is that it's unlike anything else. It's unlike photography, it's unlike 3D printing or VR or AR, whatever. 3D scanning really depends on the subject. And that right. It can be very small details, like you can not even like define room scanning, like what can I use to scan a room? The first question I ask is like, what kind of room?
And perhaps even what is the end result going to be work back?
Exactly, yeah. Right? What's the target purpose for it?
Yeah, let's start with a room. Let's say I want to scan my living room. For any purposes. Is there a one size fits all approach right now that you put out there? And if not, then what are the different possibilities that someone could go down?
It's interesting that from the very first moment that I started promoting myself as a 3D capture expert, room scanning has been the number one question that people have asked me. Somehow everyone wants to capture interiors. And the fact is that interiors are the most complex things in general, because they are usually large and full of stuff and contain that there is this list of like impossible things to scan, like reflective things, transparent things, very dark things. And a room usually contains all of those. Like,
yes,
very bad light conditions, mixes of indoor lighting and outdoor lighting that also changes. Like, that's the worst thing for photogrammetry, that you need to take like 1,000 photographs, but during your shoot, daylight has changed significantly, so there is no consistency. So room scanning is the big thing that people are asking about. And it's actually one of the things I haven't yet covered on my blog, because it is so complex. And because there are still the stuff that's there to do it is still under development. And a lot of very cool stuff that is under development for scanning rooms with depth sensors is still very much in the academic sphere. So these are all these papers from universities with GitHub compilable source codes that no one understands. But there's no commercial software to do it. And then there was this very small time that there was Google Tango, which was exciting to scan interiors. And then it was gone again.
Now it's gone. I have a question regards this particular problem. So we accidentally picked up the most difficult case, the room, and it's great. And what I see, at least from a distance, because, I mean, the topic of 3D scanning is super fascinating to me as to Azad, but I'm not so much involved as Azad or you, right? But still, I kind of see that when you look at photography, there is right now a great improvement in software-made photography. So the camera sensor that I have on my phone is kind of as similar as a few years ago, but the photos seem to be way better because the sensor starts to understand the context, what are those things, is applying magic.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, with my very simple understanding of 3D scanning, is that when you are actually going to be able to scan a room, you need also to train the software to understand the context of the room, of the different objects. And is this something we are slowly going to, or are we still at a phase where, you know, the sensors are being distributed among, or is there actually someone like Apple or Google considering, you know, adding this functionality like Tango had in a very simple way back into the mobile devices?
Yeah, I think the more general question is, and I've been starting to cover that recently, is how big the impact of AI will be on 3D capture. Like a lot of questions I get from people that want to solve something with 3D capture, the answer is sometimes that 3D capture is not necessarily the technology to use, because you don't have to have a volumetric scan that is totally perfect of something to be able to do simple measurements, for instance. And there have been these demos lately of the ability to scan humans that are just rotating casually in place in a park, that that would be something that's impossible to do with photogrammetry software. It would be a total mess. But with AI and machine learning, you can generate a very accurate 3D model of a person that way. Because you're training the software to do something specific, in this case, scanning a human, so it knows what to expect, like a pose and joints and general shape. So that's very interesting.
The hardware for capturing things in 3D is still currently, I guess, like the different things that you're covering really show that, obviously, first of all, it takes more components, more specialized components, whether it's like time of flight IR or, you know, I'm sure you can cover some of the different hardware requirements you'd need in either in cameras or LiDAR scanners. But what you're saying is that perhaps for some applications and for a lot of applications when it comes to consumer technology, what we're seeing now is that the software is actually able to make up for not needing to require as advanced forms of like hardware on these technologies.
Yeah,
right?
I think these algorithms are especially good at filling in the blanks. Because with 3D capture, especially complex scenes and interiors, there are always these obscured areas that are mainly in the shadow of the sensor that will never be captured. And like a few years back, that would rely on filling this stuff with ugly polygons. And now with AI, these technologies can like anticipate what would have been behind something and fill in the blanks more realistically. Which is great for platforms like VR that now allow you to look a bit further around corners and stuff like that. Because before that, the viewpoint was very
limited. It's kind of very similar to how the brain works, right? Just to draw the analogy, there are a lot of optical illusions that the human visual system and our perception in general is basically targeted by, and it's not like we perceive the world perfect, but we can, because we understand the context and the meaning of objects, actually interact with them in a meaningful way. There is this very famous picture of a lot of chairs in a room, and there is one chair on the ceiling that is a lamp, and one chair is a reflection of a chair, and one chair is kind of a desk, and one chair is a picture of a chair, and one chair is a shadow of a chair. And the question is how to teach a computer to actually understand whether the shadow is not a chair, but actually the shadow of a chair, and the lamp looks like a chair, but it's actually a lamp. And I think I would ask you the following question. Do you consider that augmented reality still is not as perfect as everyone expects to, because we lack the capability of understanding 3D structured space? And the moment that we actually can teach a computer or a machine to understand this living room scenario in a perfect way, we can actually have finally augmented reality working good?
Yeah, I know that there is a lot of this AI-assisted 3D capture tech that is in development that nobody has seen yet. And I was writing the other day, last week or something, about the new Facebook Memories thing.
Yes.
They apparently created something that can pull a few photos from a family party from your photo library and generate a point cloud of the entire room from that. It's, for me, it's like, how does that work then? How do they remove the people from the scene, fill in the blanks, and make a complete scene? Because when I think about the photographs I'm taking at the party, there would never be enough information to create even a part of a room. I'd mainly shoot like people from nearby and maybe a little bit of background, but it's always about the people. And they pretend like, just give us some even old photographs and we'll generate the room. And I'm like, how?
As far as I understood it, I thought they were more relying on video captured in the room and then extracting frames from that video. But you're right. As in, if for any purposes that you would be taking either pictures or videos inside of your room, you're most likely not just shooting an empty part of your room, right? You want people to be.
Unless you're a real estate agent.
Right.
Then so you have these video walkthroughs that they are all doing through an empty house or a furnished house.
There are two options. Either we already have secret spy cameras installed by Facebook in all our homes, or they figured a way to do it similar to a brain, because if I would actually show you the same footage that their algorithm uses, you might at least produce the outline of the room and maybe kind of, you know, predict the geometry based on your understanding of the physical world. And when you add to that the RGB information from the video, it seems to be enough. But it's crazy that they managed to teach a machine to actually have all those assumptions, as it seems in their demo.
Yeah. So... I really want to go into the consumer side of this technology and its implications. We'll get back to this later on in the episode. But I think, Peter, you hit on something really interesting describing how we as humans perceive the rooms that we're sitting in. We actually are a single point capture technology, right? If you're sitting in one chair, you're not sitting on the other side of the room and seeing what's behind that table. But because of your past experiences of seeing tables from many different sides, and perhaps even that table specifically in the past, in the days and weeks past, you do have that top-down processing of what that room is supposed to look like. And you can fill in the new information from the new, with that single point perspective that you have. And it's interesting seeing that now with, I guess, AI is hopefully trying to do similar things with filling in the gaps of the perspectives that capture module doesn't have, right? And maybe Nick, you can point to this, like, what are the interesting companies that we can look at, or what are the pieces of news that excites you about this this next generation of capture technology that is AI powered, that it is AI assisted? Are there things out there yet that are exciting?
The things I've seen so far, except from the recent Facebook announcements, are still very much in academic process of being like the papers and stuff. So it's not like commercially out there for you to try. And that's always hard for me, because the one thing I've learned from 3D capture is that to even give an opinion about it, I have to try it for myself. And sometimes people get tired of all the same objects I always use, but I do that because I know the objects very well and I know what to expect. And they all
it's controlling variables.
It's very hard for me to accept that just casually rotating in place can capture a human with, like, I read something like a 5 millimeter accuracy. Like, how based on HD footage, how can that be possible? So I want to test things first, because then I can give a good opinion. But for to go back to the thing you said before, the AI question, like the perception of reality, that's actually something I've been talking about even today. When you're talking about VR and perception of reality compared to the perception of actual reality, is that what's happening right now is that it's almost the same, like what could be called like uncanny valley for digital actors. Like, people can perfectly sympathize with cartoon characters, which are not realistic at all, and they can do that with like filmed characters. But when trying to simulate something very close to reality, which is essentially what reality capture is, we have this feeling about what's right and what's not. So a very simple VR scene with a bunch of like purple geometry can be very immersive, while almost perfect photogrammetry 3D capture of the same room feels slightly off and can break the immersion. So that's interesting for me. Because what's the goal that you have?
Do you think that's due to, how would you attribute that? Is it because we, with animations, with cartoon characters, it's almost like you extract the important elements of emotion, which now I've learned to be like, eyebrows are probably one of the most important things that a cartoon character needs to have. But when you get closer to reality, to trying to simulate every little muscle movement in the face, you don't have it exactly right? Or how would you describe that like difference?
I think that's the whole uncanny valley thing. Like, that's it's hard to describe, but people feel it or something. And I think you can have it with people especially, but you can also have it with environments. Like I've done a lot of demos with HD5 where people were walking through this Van Gogh painting.
It's really good.
I think everybody knows the cafe something. I think it's even on Sketchfab. Yeah, and there's mm-hmm. audio with it, so you can walk a bit
and meet him.
Van Gogh's room in this mm-hmm. painting style. Meet him in person, but it's all stylized and it works pretty well for the immersion. But I've also done some walkthroughs with the HC5 into like captured environments. And when it's like a cave or something, it works for me. Like archaeological findings that are being 3D captured with photogrammetry, because I don't know what it would be like for real. But I've also made a 3D capture of my own office I don't have it anymore, but where the HC5 was actually situated. So I was walking in VR in the 3D capture of the same room that I was in, like kind of Inception style. And because I know the room very well, then it's sort of not okay. And especially with like furniture in rooms and flat stuff, and it's very hard to do right. Organic stuff like caves and maybe church and stuff like that can be very convincing, but somehow the simpler rooms are harder to.
So my mind was kind of blown away the first time I tried the HoloLens, because it was like some closed room demo on a big exhibition, and it was like super guided. But when I was actually perceiving this 3D object, whatever it was, on a desk, and I bent it and looked under the desk, I couldn't see the object anymore. But with iAirKit or iAirCore, I kind of don't have that. So when I place an object on a surface and I kind of go with the phone below it, I still see it kind of, right? And I think,
that's cool.
It's still a big problem, but it's like those small details, whether the physics behaves right, whether the shadows fall right, I guess our eyes can pick it up very easily. But what's with Reality's IO and their application? So I tried it many times and they have like this huge environments scanned pretty detailed, and it doesn't feel very uncanny valley. I mean, those are not necessarily places I visited myself, but it still feels very realistic. Or actually even this mountain from, how's it called? The Steam Lab experience? I don't know, the
Everest
from the lab, yes. I always put people there.
The lab.
It looks gorgeous.
Yeah,
and it doesn't really feel unnatural. How do they do it? What's their trick?
Yeah. I don't know. I think that, of course, that's an outdoors area. So that's also different than indoors, because it's like I think naturally when you're in such an environment, you tend to look out and don't focus on very small details. I think it's not very different than the kind of immersion you get in like a console game or anything. Like you can like walk through an open field or an open world and be excited, but you will not walk up to a tree stump and like examine the tree stump. But when you put someone in a very small room, you're tempted to like check all the details, and everything is much closer to you.
Right. And I think having things be within arm's reach also encourages people to want to interact with those things. Yep. You know, that's what do you do when you're in your friend's room for the first time,
or
you know,
books.
Someone's room, and you kind of are curious. You want to know who this person is, right?
Like
you're
very
like,
close.
This guy, like what? Very close.
Books,
you pick up the things that are on their desk and you like get a better understanding. Yeah. And
did you try Blade Runner experience, the indoors Blade Runner experience? You
no,
should
I
check
don't think
that
so.
Out. That's someone, I think it's not even an official thing. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a fan made thing, but they essentially made the main character's room, a condo room, very realistically as a VR experience. You can download it from Steam, and that's very interesting, because a lot of stuff is interactive, and you can the detailing is very very well done. But it's not a captured room of design.
Right. It is. You're right. It's a fan-made VR app called Blade Runner 9732.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing an Upload VR article saying that it's going to be removed from Steam due to but not by Warner Brothers. So we, as to whether it, this is still out is debatable. I have to find it. I'm very curious now. So in that, that wasn't a 3D scan version, right? That was probably something that was modeled.
Yeah. Because there isn't a real version of it to capture, I think.
But you have
maybe somewhere in a
maybe you could you know, apply the Facebook algorithms and just recreate.
Yeah.
Or maybe you could technically apply Facebook algorithms that are used for this party room recreation, actually to you know, create those virtual movies similar as in Ready Player One.
Yeah, I think there have been some interesting demos of. Of parts of video that have been pulled into photogrammetry software to make a photometric environment, like stuff from music videos that have moving cameras on rails are ideal for such things. And then you can essentially create a 3D version of your favorite part of a movie or part of a music video and be able to walk in.
Right. Or let's say like aerial shots, drone shots from within a movie that are you know, orbiting a specific scene. Oh, yeah, those are perfect to just pull the frames out.
Like introduction scenes.
Recreate. Yeah, I've done a few of those, but I actually need to dedicate like a weekend to sitting down and watching just like some of my favorite films and finding scenes that are just so perfect. And they're like just cutting those out.
The Matrix scene should be good, right? Where the cameras rotate around him, you know, dodging bullets.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think
Matrix.
Yeah, but there's still a bit of movement in the. It's not totally static. They're like offset a little bit.
That's plus, hard. There's a lot of motion blur that happens a lot in film shots because you know the environment is less important than the subjects. And typically, I think maybe you can correct me with VFX. They've been using these both photogrammetry and LiDAR capture to do set capture and set extensions, and they're not as concerned about how high of a fidelity those captures are because they end up blurring, you know, they're using bokeh and you're concentrating more on the subjects, like actors talking and blurring out the background. So as long as it looks somewhat realistic and can respond to lighting changes, then you can get away with it. But now with VR and with real-time engines, these technologies have to be are going to the point of like these need to work in real time, and they need to stand up to like someone literally going and sticking their head right so close to it and seeing the same amount of fidelity.
Yeah.
And
also
yeah,
depth. Also depth of field, I think, because that's essentially what you're saying, that in cinematic environments you use depth of field to blur out the background, and in VR everything is in focus. Because there isn't, like, you have this Vovi headset that does iris tracking or something that can blur the background based on your own focus. I never tried it for real, so I don't know if it. Did you ever try it?
We've had a podcast.
It's still lying on my shelf. It's working interestingly, and I think Azad also tried this headset with the mirror rotating projection foveated rendering.
No, they that form of that headset is coming soon, but I have tried foveated rendering headsets actually in a Gear VR. Who was it? So SMI had a Gear VR version before they were acquired by Apple that had foveated rendering. And so, was probably one of the first ones to implement that idea with eye trackers, but that is going to be for sure a feature of the generation two of these VR headsets. That even actually, let's talk about this first. Second, Facebook announced at F8 a prototype version of a Rift headset that has very focal displays, where with eye tracking they know obviously where you're looking at in the scene, but if you hold up an object very close to your face in VR, currently it's blurry because you know you can't focus on things that are closer than like half a meter or something, or perhaps it's a little bit smaller than that, but with very focal displays they're literally moving they're moving the one of the lenses or both of the lenses closer or further away from your eye, and so that you can focus on things differently. And as an effect of that, you just get real true field of view blurring and that bokeh that we're also used to. Yeah.
I'm curious to how fast they can pull it off, because human focusing is very fast.
It is, but I mean, one third of your time that you're seeing, you're not really seeing, your eye is moving. During that time, you're not perceiving anything. And also you close your eyes, you have microsaccades, you have saccades. Then again, the eye is a muscle, right? It also has a certain... Yeah, it's pretty slow.
It's actually not that fast. Like, comparing...
It's not instant.
I think it was Apple that announced a few years ago something called like Deep Pixels, or it was essentially a way of doing autofocus very quickly from things that are closer and further away. And comparing how fast I can change my focus from a close hand. Yeah, the focus that happens between in your eye is a little bit slower than your iPhone's focus from switching from things. So anyway, there's a lot that I think can be improved there to match the real. How we actually perceive things. No. But I think that moves us, Nick, to like, I guess, VR headsets. And typically when we do these podcasts, we host them in VR. We meet up in VR and we have hands and all these cool things, the reasons why we do them in VR. You, I think, would be like such an ideal person to have a VR headset because you work with 3D. And what you told me is that you used to have headsets and now you don't. So tell us a little bit about why that's so.
I think I owned almost every headset out there. I started like, I think 4 years ago with the DK2 Oculus Rift. And that was very much, when I was still running, my animation studio business. And we were, my co-founder and I were like, investigating, a move to real-time 3D. And VR was a natural like next step for us. And but then we quickly realized that creating content for 2D video output is so much different than creating for real-time 3D. It actually never came really out of the R&D phase. But it did interest me in VR. So after that one, we got the Gear VR, and that totally convinced me that like 3DOF mobile stuff is not VR, period. So, and that actually drove like my sort of negativity towards 360 photography, because it was not. I'm a 3D person, and that's not 3D. It's not reality or something. So that's a nice bridge to what you're saying about light fields. But in between that, I got the HC5 first, which I really liked. But the office I'm in right now, I always have to like move all stuff out of place to be even step into VR. And then I got tethered to my PC that was on the other side of the room. And so it was really impractical. And I found that the threshold to casually step into VR was very high. And every time I wanted to step in, I had to do like 25 Steam updates and whatnot, firmware updates. And so I liked being in VR. I also had an Oculus Rift. And I didn't really like the seated experience thing. I was like, okay, VR should be like free locomotion, even though it's just a 4x4 meters space. It worked for me quite well. And, but the thing I engaged in most was like in VR creation, like Tiltbrush and Google Blocks. So because my background as a 3D designer and animator, I like these creation tools the most. I'm not into gaming a lot, so I didn't do a lot of games, some simulations, but I like 3D gaming, and I totally see the thing I think still is the killer feature for VR is like collaborative creation.
Right.
Like being able to, yeah.
Did you find value in these VR creation tools and how they fit into your current workflows?
But mainly what I like about creating stuff in VR is that's the only way you can digitally create stuff at scale, like at 100% scale. On a computer, you're essentially working on a very small scale on a screen, and you're zooming in and zooming out to create details. While in VR, you just move closer. And then you sculpt a little bit of detail, and then you step further away or walk around something. And then the workflow was very liberating in that sense. But for professional purposes, it was also very exhausting. So I've been doing some like Tilbrush stuff for like half an hour, and I was totally exhausted. And especially because the headset is still quite heavy and sweaty and warm and foggy and whatnot. So it was fun, but I cannot see with this current generation of VR headsets, like professionals that have deadlines and need to produce like a lot of content.
So interesting. I mean, I think VR, I have to like, out myself in this podcast finally. I didn't buy a VR headset since a few years neither. I have still somewhere a Gear VR lying around. Yeah, I'm a terrible person. I'm like, I think I'm very close to buying one, but I usually either have access to the VR headsets at work or I take them home to record the podcast. But whenever I, you know, have to show VR, have to set it up, have to use VR, even though I'm deeply fascinated by the HTC Vive and also the Oculus, it's always, as you described, you know, updates. Oh, yeah, Steam needs to be restarted. Or when I do mixed reality recordings, oh, a computer needs to be updated. Oh, mixed reality tells me to use my voice, even though I don't want it to. Oh, you know, some kind of game crashed and I have to restart it. And it's was kind of different yesterday when I tried the Oculus Go. You just put it on and it works, even though big screen crashed a few times. But it kind of feels more like a device that would be easier to use every day, so I'm really considering getting one of those. But what do you think needs to change with the VR tools, with the way you interact, and also with the headsets and ergonomics that you would actually use it every day? How would you imagine your perfect headset?
Wireless and with inside-out tracking, I think. Because I think like being able to move around is way more important than most people think. I think it's not even about moving around a lot, but even the natural wobble of your head and the slight parallax that gives is like can deliver so much more immersion than not having that feature.
Yeah, I think even just the parallax aspect is probably enough to convince certain people that work with 3D to use it just even as a display, even if they're going to use, let's say, a mouse and keyboard, where I think is you can still have natural things with the controllers. But the parallax aspect is huge for 3D work. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think even a little bit of movement is enough to be convincing. And then there is this aspect that we just talked about, like being able to just put it on and start it. Like I've always been a fan of console gaming versus PC gaming for that very reason. Like I want that to be like a relaxing experience. So I just want to put my PlayStation on and be gaming in seconds. Yeah. Because I don't have a lot of spare time. So when I want to do something, I want to do it right now. Half an hour and then leave it and come back to it later.
And you don't want to deal with driver updates, you know, every time you want to play a video game.
No. For the Vive, at first it worked better because I bought a PC especially for VR, which was just set up as a VR PC. But then I discovered that the video card inside of it was great for photogrammetry. So I started using it for all kind of 3D capture purposes, and then it became like a working machine and not a dedicated VR. So I moved it onto my desk instead of...
It makes sense. I think this new headset at some point will announce. I think the shorter is a Santa Cruz, I think, is the newest one. So there's inside-out tracking and 6 degrees of freedom and a standalone Azad Red. Is it Santa Cruz or...
Yeah, Santa Cruz is a fully all-in-one headset that has inside-out tracking for both positional tracking of the headset, but also tracking of the two 6DoF controllers, which right now is still unachieved or at least any of the consumer headsets don't have full two-hand tracking. So we're like, I think you're totally valid in terms of the ergonomics and the user experience problems of the current high-end VR headsets. Yeah. It's first generation. It requires a lot of someone to want to go into VR, you know, like and you talked about, especially if you have room scale VR, it's a whole thing, like move things out of the way, put on the headset, make sure it's not hot inside because you'll fog up the display. And especially with the DK2 back in the day, that was a big problem for me. I run a few degrees hotter than most people, I guess. But I think there's a lot of there's huge rooms of improvement, and all these headset manufacturers are directly trying to answer these questions. Yeah. I think the question of whether or not this is going to be a useful tool, I think kind of comes back to you and to professionals that work in 3D all the time. Do you think they perhaps have been jaded by what exists today versus what will exist in the next 3 years to thinking? Or do you think the whole industry itself will be at that point where if you don't have a headset as a 3D professional in 5 years, mm-hmm. then you're probably going to, you're missing out on huge improvements in your workflow and experiences?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm not too convinced if that's the time frame for it, like a few years from now. I don't see that's why I make the verification between doing it for fun or at a more artistic level, or doing it like for design purposes, which are like very time and budget driven. And I know a lot of people that do 3D modeling and 3D sculpting, and everybody likes being able to sculpt in VR. But people that do this for a living, which I'm not, but like very good, like ZBrush sculptors, can do incredible stuff very fast with a simple, like a $300 Wacom tablet and their hand on the keyboard. Like they know all the shortcuts, so they can work productively very fast and very accurate as well. So there is no accuracy improvement with VR. There is no time improvement with VR. It's only an experience improvement. And I think the collaborative improvement, that's the thing that cannot be matched.
I think there is traditional way. Also a certain aspect of VR that you mentioned before, this ability to move around, that maybe right now doesn't give someone who is doing 3D art design a big value, but for example, in the product that we are building, where I'm working at, we focus on the planning part of production facilities. And there, the easiness of VR allows for the blue collar workers and manager, but also the production planner and also the 3D expert who does all the cut modeling, actually to enter together VR and explore it. But you can also even plan it in VR, and it's kind of simpler than sitting in front of a paper and then digitizing it, or actually using a complex tool. So while I think doing really precise or really good or really like the final stage of a model or a plan or a planning facility or whatever is definitely right now and might even be for longer times better on a PC, I think the rough sketches, even for 3D art in general, should be better through VR. And I could maybe draw an example from smartphone versus PC. So I had to edit a recent episode of our podcast on my iPhone, which worked surprisingly well. It just took me 5 hours instead of one, because even though the software was totally capable of managing this huge amount of data, like one, I think 2 gigabytes of audio raw file on the iPhone, crazy, it managed. But touching the touchscreen is actually difficult compared to a mouse and keyboard. And with VR, it's kind of similar because you don't have yet that precision that you usually have with a mouse or keyboard. And VR is in a similar way, kind of like a touchscreen. It is very intuitive, but intuitiveness doesn't necessarily lead always to effectiveness, right? It takes a certain amount of time to learn your perfect cut model program. And when you know the shortcuts, you're good. But when you just take someone who is not very experienced and someone who is already very experienced, both of them will be kind of doing fine with the VR part, which is limited, but obviously the expert is way better with this productive software. But the the person who is not particularly good at 3D art at all is still being enabled through VR, right? So maybe at that level it will change the landscape in the next 5 to 10 years, or do you think that it's just too much expectation?
I think that's exactly I think the analogy between the difference between a desktop computer and a tablet is very, very great also for VR, because when I look at like video production, I don't see anyone producing professional video editing on an iPad yet. But I do see a lot of people that are in editing that do the rough editing, like on the plane back to the studio on an iPad, loading the EDL into like Premiere Pro or Final Cut Pro or Effort or whatnot, and then doing the actual editing there. So for sketching and prototyping, that's actually, I believe, because my background is in creative production, that at early stages of creative work, it's actually a benefit that technology is limited. So I've always preferred to do storyboarding, and I've done a lot of storyboarding for my animation studio in the past 5 years on paper. Not any type of funky tablet or whatever, just paper, because it's limiting. There's a black marker with a set thickness and a piece of paper. You cannot delete stuff. You can just draw, and you can work creatively. And then when everything is lined out, you can just like maybe scan it or trace it.
But it's not just limiting you. It's also enabling you, because in a way, a computer has more features, particularly for storyboarding, but you don't have this ability to just, you know, draw a circle or just move your hand slightly there, make a zigzag line, whatever, as you would do in real life. So the functionality is limited, but what you have is limitless. So how you draw the line is totally to you compared to, you know, on the tablet, and you have the precision of the pen or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's why in VR, the best tool for that is still brush for me, because there are now these 3D, real 3D modeling or sculpting tools in VR that are trying to do what desktop software is doing in VR, which doesn't quite work for me. But what TiltBrush does is something that hasn't been able to exist before, because on a desktop PC, you cannot draw or paint in 3D. It's simply not possible. So it's essentially 3D sketching. And I've seen a lot of artists use TiltBrush as a 3D sketching mechanism, collaborative or not, or maybe solo, to do rough sketching of maybe a character, like for character design or fashion characters or whatever, or even environments, and then load the OBG into like Maya or Cinema 4D or ZBrush or whatever, and then creating the actual scene from that. Because doing that sketch work on a desktop PC is actually not even possible to sketch.
It's also, from what I've understood for working with some 3D artists, is that there's actually a big disconnect between a 3D modeler and a 3D artist. When one of the artists doing the concept work for a film or a game versus the artist that, or the modeler that's actually building the production ready assets. Yeah. Those are actually two different people that work on two different things. And what I'm starting to see now is that they're starting to blend in a little bit, because the sketching traditionally was either happening on a Wacom tablet or even pen and paper, and that isn't 3D. That doesn't particularly translate into production, and they have to recreate that from those concepts. And now the concept is actually starting to become the production ready asset, or at least in a way, like, there is a real 3D model that the modeler can work off of to optimize for production. Yeah. And another, I think I would like to offer a counterpoint to the time aspect of VR. So I would agree in terms of the accuracy. VR creation tools don't offer the same accuracy levels that a experienced ZBrush modeler can achieve with 5 years or 10 years of experience with all the hotkeys and shortcuts. But from what I'm hearing from artists is that the time it takes to create iterative, to iterate on any idea is so fast that it ends up becoming a way in, it reduces the time to create something. So to make, three different versions of an environment takes way less time to do in VR, even though it's not accurate per se. But if the thing you're trying to create is the idea that you have in your head to a asset that you can use to storyboard off of, VR is right, killing it right now.
Yeah, I think that what you're essentially saying, that it's an awesome prototyping tool, like conceptualizing tool. Because you can create quite fast. And that is cool. And that is like new. And then you can move it down the pipeline to make it pretty.
And I think where the intersection with already existing tools will really make a lot of sense is when the VR headset is cheap enough and can run on already, let's say, like 90 or 80% of computers that professionals use. And you can use, let's say you're already using ZBrush, but having a headset that you can quickly put on to see it, to have that parallax view that you were talking about, I think can be extremely valuable using the already the tools that you know how to use. I think that's, rather than trying to reinvent the entire user interface of like how to do you do 3D work, I think using it as a display can just augment your already existing workflows. And we're starting to see a little bit of that. Like, we don't, you know, ZBrush doesn't have a VR viewer, but I think it was Digital Foundry like released a 3D tool that is a normal 2D tool that also has a VR component, and you can go back and forth, you know, instantly. I think
the game engines are doing it, like Unreal and Unity, and both have like in VR creation tool sets that are constantly developing. Like, you're creating your VR game in VR,
right?
Which makes sense. And I also think for tools like Tiltbrush and Oculus Medium and Quill, that there is like a new style coming out of that hasn't been seen before. So it's like a more painting style that has been done before in like real painting and 2D, but not in 3D necessarily.
Very edgy.
Like 3D used to be like very either very like low polygon or very realistic, but not a lot of in between.
Yeah, not a lot of the abstract forms,
no, exactly,
2D paintings now being in 3D. You're totally right about that. Let's bring it back to some of the capture technologies we were talking about and connect it to mobile phones and consumer tech. Do you see a big future with these capture technologies becoming useful for everyday consumers to capture and to experience?
Yeah, I think, of course, I cannot predict the future, but I do realize that what made video big and things like YouTube big was essentially user-generated content. So, like liberating content creation has been huge for video and photography both. So for these 3D aware, volumetric 3D mediums like AR, I think the key to success is enabling everyone to create content. So, I think the smartphone is the device to do that.
Right. I think, yeah, you're right in the sense that video and photography became the bigger industry that it is today because of the user-generated content and the ability to sell things through those, right? Like Instagram, the fact that it does so well is because you have people with a lot of followers being able to promote, you know, whatever products, or it's a way of it's a distribution channel that before you had to go through advertisers on TV. Mm-hmm. And now content creators and product manufacturers actually have direct distribution channels.
Yeah.
I guess it's definitely a question I ask myself, right? Like, is there value for a consumer for them to either capture their favorite teddy bear in 3D or capture themselves in 3D, you know, or capture their rooms? You work a lot with the consumer tech that exists today, right?
Yep.
Like let's name a few. The Bellus 3D face camera pro for the Android. Yep. The iSense 3D scanner. Can you give us an overview of what exists today? Are they useful and what are they useful for? And perhaps also extrapolate a little bit into the future of what should exist and what will.
Yeah, I think that all those examples, like the depth sensors, like the add-on Bellus 3D camera that I tested recently, and all the depth sensors before that, like the 3D systems sense scanner, they're all targeted. They used to be targeted at consumers when these companies were still believing that 3D printing was going to be huge for consumers.
Hmm.
So they were promoting in the early days, like I think 2 or 3 years back, they were promoting depth sensor scanning like a copy machine thing. Like, you have the 3D printer and now you have the 3D scanner, so you can take your favorite action figure or shoe, scan it and print it. So that obviously didn't take off. And and I think for consumers to embrace 3D capture, it needs to be like built into phones. So I'm really excited about the pure software things that companies like Sony are doing on the Xperia phones, like almost real time AR assisted photogrammetry essentially. And I think the AR part there is very interesting because the missing link between like photography and being able to capture stuff in 3D is because it's new for people. So everyone knows how to take a photograph now on a smartphone, and it's all like well-known stuff. You press a button, you have a photo. But 3D capture is essentially very hard.
Especially if
you haven't done it before, it's hard.
I want to ask two questions. One is, what's about the iPhone, the double camera layout, and also in other phones where it technically creates this bokeh effect fakishly, but I have tried to actually open those photos that are produced by the iPhone with another app, I think it's called Focus, and there you actually see that the photo is not flat, it's actually having those intersections, it's actually creating a depth map, and then you can even change the focus back and forth, and this is basically nothing else than understanding the structure of the room just from one perspective. And another example would be, there was a Verge article, I will put it in the show notes, about a studio that kind of 3D captures children. So there are basically people going there and their children are playing around and they're being basically recorded volumetrically. And then it's like a volumetric memory that you can keep. And another thing that they did was basically capture veterans or people who were survivors of the Holocaust or something like that. And later on, they added AI, and you could ask questions. Yeah. It was like someone who died already, but he could tell you, or the person could tell you the story through this AI chat version. It's also kind of consumer oriented. You just go to a studio similar as you would go 60 or even 30 years ago to a photography studio to make photos of your children, right?
Yeah, I think that's also a big difference. Like, depending on the use case, you can either opt for like more centralized 3D scanning, like you have to go somewhere and scan something, and then you have it. Like one topic I hear a lot about is like scanning feet to know shoe sizes and stuff like that. So you don't have to order the wrong shoe size and get the perfect measurements of your feet. You can, of course, do it in two ways. You can put a good 3D scanner in a sneaker store where people usually go to buy shoes and do the scanning once there, or you can try to put it off on a smartphone so people can do it at their homes. So those are two like consumer-focused use cases that are totally different when it comes to the technology used, because doing it on a smartphone is still very hard because there are a lot of different ones.
But the question remains, like, how much better is, is the shoe buying experience if going down that route of 3D scanning your feet versus, you know, how we've been doing it for the past 100 years with I don't know how much error rates, you know, we have when it comes to shoes. And actually, it's funny, right? Like, we, for the longest time when the internet was coming around, people, I thought, say that they had the hardest time believing that e-commerce of clothes and shoes was going to be a thing. And one of the biggest things currently on Amazon that owns, Amazon Prime is owned by at least 50% of American households, like, is clothes. And so even though that's not particularly something we realized would be very popular, but like, it really is. And I question as to how important these 3D technologies will be for industries that are already doing just fine without them.
Yeah.
Perhaps until the hardware itself is like integrated, and it's not, the main focus of that hardware isn't to scan your feet and to put shoes on it, right? It's like, that's a byproduct of an already existing technology, like the two cameras on your iPhone. I really see like that.
You need this technology in order for augmented reality to work properly. And augmented reality is going to be the major driving force of the consumers, because they all want it. And you clearly see it.
Maybe.
Well, but with VR, I mean, that's what we discussed today, you know, it's not necessarily that VR will enable you to easily design a full CAD model of a motor way quicker than before. But augmented reality is something that everyone wants to, because you basically have your phone in the pocket, you need to take it out, you need to check your messages. You would love them to be, you know, displayed on some kind of surfaces around you, or having virtual avatars running around you. I mean, it's just basically the magical world we have been dreaming since we were children, and everyone wants it. And the only thing that stands in the way of it is not even the optics. I mean, the optics can be improved too, but just basically the computer finally understanding the world around us. And that's basically the enabler for all the consumer technology.
Yeah, I actually don't, I'm not convinced that everybody wants it. My opinion about both VR and AR is currently that it's still in the phase like we're doing it because we can technically do it, but that's mainly from a technical perspective. And when you look at it from a business perspective, I very much doubt that it can be beneficial for every use case possible. I think when you look at e-commerce, there are a lot of if you're with your nose in 3D capture stuff all the time, and you follow all the feeds of 3D capture companies that are developing 3D capture software or hardware, of course they think that every experience is better with volumetric 3D models. Like even shopping on Amazon would be better if you can freely rotate around an object before you buy it. But I'm very skeptical about it. I don't believe that it will, and I don't have the research or knowledge about it essentially, but good product photography tells a lot of information about a product. And it's, you can still create very marvelous photos of any object that you want. And then a lot of companies are coming to me to get informed about the possibilities to, for instance, do 3D capture for e-commerce. And the thing you always go into is that you can actually not capture a lot of stuff in 3D. Like many everyday objects like this glass, you can make great photographs of it, but it's simply impossible to capture now and in the future or whatever. It will never be done. Maybe 100 years from now, but until then, it will not be able to be captured. And so you cannot sell it that way. And you don't want a website with only a few models
capture the light field in a similar way as Google did with their new VR experience, where they had like this area of cameras going around people or objects. And I tried it with a Vive Pro, and it was like amazing how realistic it looks. And when you just have an area of cameras.
So that's very interesting. Yeah, because light field technology, that's a very cool thing to talk about, because is it 3D capture or not? Is it like more of an evolution of photography, or is it like an evolution of like stereoscopic photography, like just adding more? It's even hard for most people to imagine, comprehend what a light field is currently.
But it has no geometry, geometric information, it's just a light field. So technically it's photography, right?
No. Well, it does have geometry information and the depth maps that no, but that can be extracted. Like, I'm not saying it's the final experience is something that the geometry is needed. There, from what I understand, it's the interpolation of the camera positions between those two cameras. Let's say even if you have two cameras, stereo cameras, it's the ability to have the perspectives that are between those
two cameras,
which is essentially what a light field processing that does. But And I agree. I think for a lot of purposes, perhaps not having the geometry isn't the most important part, especially when it comes to hard things like glasses and transparent things. But it's that ability to perhaps have that slight parallax, like that you can move your head or your smartphone through, which leads to perhaps was seen, right? The app that was acquired by Snapchat, was it, Nick?
Yeah.
And you have a blog post about, like, is Facebook doing the next version of Scene, where they take a normal 2D photo that you've snapped on your phone, but extrapolate a depth map from it and give you that slight parallax. Is that a form of Is that how you can see this consumer side being applied? Is that you have still a fixed framing of a shot, but you have the free perspective that you can kind of wiggle within?
I actually, one of the most popular posts on my blog was a list of free 3D capture tools that were out there. And over the past 2 years, I have been editing that blog post until it was gone because none of those technologies exist anymore. Like it listed like 1, 2, 3D Catch and I believe two others, and also Scene. And I wrote a special part about Scene because it wasn't really like a full 360 3D capture. But it was very fast to do. You only had to move your phone like a few millimeters and it would capture it, and it would be render very fast and be instantly be publishable to the Scene social network, which was like a 3D aware Instagram clone essentially.
Right.
And that's actually what Facebook is doing now. And I believe they have a bit more sophisticated algorithms to do that. But it's essentially the effect of adding a little parallax combined with the gyroscope on your phone. It's just a little depth effect. And it of course, that would never work in VR. And I've when talking about the light field stuff, I've also tried the demos of the light field stuff in on the Vive. And then it would be like, cool, until you moved a little bit too fast and then you're out of the sphere or something, right. And then it would break the illusion. But for mobile phones, I think that kind of 3D is the first step to introduce 3D capture to a wider audience, because it adds a little bit more immersion or interactivity to otherwise static photos.
So from a consumer perspective, if I am right now basically the average consumer having the average phone and having no particularly big knowledge about 3D scanning, is there any way that I would encounter this technology and actually realize that I can capture 3D? Because with photo it's clear, everyone can make a photo. With video it's clear, with voice it's clear. But is there like an easy way to capture something 3D-wise as a consumer that exists there?
No, I don't think there is. The interesting thing is that I think it's 1 year or even 1.5 year back, there was this big announcement by Microsoft about their 3D capture plans, and they had a big stage with a presenter that walked around the sandcastle and captured in almost real time something in 3D. Mm-hmm. And then they announced the plans to create not only a Windows app for that, but also an Android app and an iPhone app. And that excited me because that would make like a cross-platform 3D capture experience that's hopefully free, that's designed by a large corporation.
Yes.
That can tie into all kinds of ecosystems, because currently it's very
native to the operating system.
Yeah,
right.
It's currently very fragmented. Like you have the I'm totally excited about the thing Sony is doing, but it's very much an Xperia flagship. It's called 3D Creator. And it's exciting, but it only works on Sony phones. And I know nobody that has a Sony phone. Like, here in the Netherlands, it's either an iPhone or a Samsung phone, or people like me that have like Android phones because they are Android geeks. And so there's no like...
What's with Animoji?
Animoji?
Yeah,
is that the same
sort of capturing 3D?
No.
Oh, that's the iPhone thing. Yeah, like that you can, that's more like facial tracking.
Samsung
is that like the facial tracking stuff?
Yes. Yes, but it is not necessarily just doing facial tracking. So technically, when you have your Snapchat open on Android or an iPhone, you can do those masks, and there is also Masquerade, which is like awesome and impressive, even without necessarily just being able to scan your face, but just applying models. But I think the Animoji from Apple is actually using the three-dimensional capture of your face to apply either filters on iPhone 10 when you have the Snapchat app or whatever, or actually change the face into some kind of poop face.
It's awesome. I'm starting to use it all the time now, and it's on. Like, if you're as expressive as I am when it comes to like talking in real life, you can make the most hilarious animoji clips that you send to friends.
There is nothing better than waking up in the morning, checking Instagram, and seeing a pic with Azad's mimic trying to say something. It's so cute. Always makes my day.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and that makes for a very good consumer use case. I think face capture, and I think that's the one thing that several companies, and you asked me before if I could give examples of companies that are doing AI stuff. And I know that the company ItSees 3D, that's well known for the structure sensor scanning app. They're also creating this 3D avatar creation SDK that can create a 3D model of an entire head from just a single selfie photograph. So I think that's also a thing, and I've been writing about it a bit, like I think a lot of companies are trying to do something for consumers with 3D and faces because it's more monetizable, like avatar creation,
right?
Like putting yourself, when you're now, when we would have done this conversation in VR, if I had a headset, we would probably choose like an Oculus Rift or a Vive character to represent ourselves. But with a 3D avatar, like a simple thing that you can either capture or generate through AI with your smartphone, you can make that presence in VR look exactly like you.
So you know what? You're this comes back full circle to what we were just talking about with cartoons and uncanny valley when it comes to photorealism, is that. So faces are really important to capture, and I think we're one of the biggest things we do with technology is communicate between each other. And it's such a funny stark contrast between how iPhone does what it does, which is essentially real-time mocap of a cartoon character, but it has those very human elements of the moving eyebrows, the ears that animate with your eyebrows, the face, the even the jawbone they model and animate in real time. And comparing that to what Samsung unveiled with their like Note 9 or whatever, and it was that you take a selfie and then it uses AI to recreate a full avatar of what you're supposed to look like, and it looked so horrible. It looked horrible, and everyone was shitting on it of like how terribly uncanny it all was. And it's just such a funny contrast, because talking about like not trying to go the full route of photorealism and that being a benefit to just keeping it to cartoony real-time avatars. It's just it's the perfect implementation of two companies approaching it from completely different directions, and engineers approaching this problem, trying to solve it from a 3D perspective. And I suspect that even people like us that have been, you know, so technically into this space, perhaps we have the wrong approach to these technologies, and you need people from completely different industries to be given a technology like facial mocap and be like, you know, what would you do with it, rather than like, oh, we should recreate the full person avatar because that's what they want to be in VR. So you want to be exactly what you look like in VR or in real life in VR. And guess what? No, maybe we just need to capture the face and the elements, the important elements of the face, and apply it to a lion's avatar, and now you're aligned with VR. Like, that's, you know, like that might be the more important thing that we will probably concentrate on in the future. Anyway, that's the end of my rant.
What I experience with face catcher, especially even when I'm giving a demo of 3D scanning and capturing stuff, and essentially capturing people at like a trade show or whatever, it's very hard to get people to let themselves be scanned. The thing I always see is that female, especially women, are totally reluctant to letting themselves be scanned. Like I think a photograph or selfie, why a selfie works maybe is because you can take like 12 and choose the best one and edit it or whatever. But a 3D scan is essentially one step closer to reality. You cannot like choose your perfect side and shoot that one, because every side will be visible. So I think people are a lot more, yeah, people are a lot more comfortable, I think, with creating like the me version, like the Nintendo me version of their after, like, okay, pull a few sliders, and maybe you can even do that with AI in a photo, like, okay, I can recognize patterns like what you're saying in your face, and I can generate a cartoony character that looks a lot like you, but it's not a photorealistic character.
So
because Instagram is not is of course a success because and also Snapchat and stuff like that because of the filters that you can hide behind filters or funny rabbit ears or sunglasses.
You have control.
Yeah.
You have control as to what is being posted, what you're posting about yourself. And you're right. It takes all those 10, 12 different selfie shots to find one that puts you in the best perspective. And it's so hard doing that, or it's impossible doing that when it is a full 3D capture.
No. And then there's the privacy thing.
Yes.
Like facial capture and like biometric information and cloud services. And especially now that we're moving into here in Europe, we're moving into the area with new laws and the GDPR and stuff like that. Like all kinds of scary privacy laws and like services like that will have a very hard time. Like especially like cloud-based facial recognition generation services will have a very hard time even existing when those laws go into get affected, like next week or the week after.
Yeah, I mean
like biometric face data.
Yeah, I mean it's happening right now. I mean in Germany you have a test with basically police using cameras on a main station in one of the cities to see if they can detect people. There is some European movement in the parliament, I think, towards basically this biometric scanning to, you know, to unite databases to make sure that everything is trackable. And I mean, it's not only the European Union working on it, it's also Facebook, Microsoft and Google and Apple working on exactly that, just for different reasons. They want to understand space and they want to show you ads and not catch you because you stole a Snickers, right? But I mean, coming back to this technology and control, I mean, there is a reason why Samsung's selfie mode comes with a face improver. So when you buy a phone from Samsung and actually make a selfie without turning it on, it's already turned on automatically. So there is like a face smoother and eyes are bigger and whatever. And it looks fascinating because you're basically not relying on the quality of the camera, but you're relying on the quality of the algorithm smoothing your skin. And I mean, there is definitely a difference between me perceiving your face in real life and me perceiving your face on camera, because I don't necessarily rely with my eyes on a manual color correction or detail correction or whatever. My brain does it automatically. And when you capture it on the screen, you know, my face starts to shine, or you actually see those details in a face that you don't necessarily would see with your eye, because, you know, 42 megapixels on a camera very close on a very bright screen are yielding more results than I can see from, you know, far away looking at you in the street, right?
Yeah, I read an article, I think, last year that stated that, like, especially in Asian markets, like, there are very few selfies posted on social networks that have not been, like, through an algorithm that corrects certain things. And I think that trend is moving towards Europe and the US now, because it's so easy to add a few AR optimized effects and make yourself like look totally smooth and stuff like that. So essentially when people are posting selfies online that you don't really know in real life, you wouldn't even
That's such a great point. Them. That's such a great point. Because I think culturally there's like a big difference between in the West with something like that perhaps being considered disgenuine, right, or ingenuine, because you think you're fooling people into being prettier than you are. But perhaps in more Asian countries, that is just it's an accepted form of like how you present yourself, right? If you're not using those filters, like
two different things.
Like it's like almost like not putting makeup and walking outside, right? In the West, at this point, it is now obviously a very accepted thing for someone to do that. But, you know, in other cultures, it's still considered like a very like, oh, like, what are you trying to do? Like attract people?
I come from Russia, and whenever I see Russian women, they usually tend to have a lot of makeup, and it really intimidates me because I'm used to woman not wearing a lot of makeup in Germany where I'm living, right? So I go on the streets, there's basically, except for a club situation or some fancy dinner, I basically never see people having a lot of makeup on, except when there's particularly those Caucasian or a Russian woman walking around, and she's just instantly hits my eye. But I have also an issue with me sending a lot of selfies as an emoji. So I kind of am lazy to find the right emoji. So I'm doing this silly face that I always think resembles this emoji. People are always not understanding what I'm, why am I sending so many selfies? And I was just, you know, I'm trying to make an emoji face. And when the iPhone would actually make me into a more emoji face, maybe it would finally hit the people. And yeah.
Dude, get an iPhone X, because with the Animojis, you don't even need to send a full clip. You can do the face, that emoji face that you're trying to do, and then grab it and then drag it into and drag it into the message.
That's interesting.
Apple being Apple, they...
Now it's, of course, yeah, only the iPhone X that has this front-facing depth sensor. And of course, Apple doesn't just try technology for their most expensive flagship phone.
No, but you can view it at least everywhere. So, I mean, it's described as a Sony phone.
In the next generation, I read that the new iPhone SE 2 or something will probably have a Face ID sensor. And I totally expect every upcoming lower iPhone to also have like front-facing scanning, and after that, maybe even back-face scanning.
It looks like, I mean, they're not using the face scanning just to do the Animoji, right? It's actually mostly for unlocking your phone, and the Animoji is more like a byproduct, which is a very great byproduct. So I guess they will at some point.
It's expressive.
Well, yes,
right. But these new technologies. Yeah. It all, well, yeah, with mass production, right, these components get cheaper. But yeah, all these byproducts have to come from a particular thing like security that it grows from. But that opens up a whole new, let's say, like platform and for opportunities for developers to suddenly take this new unexplored territory and build things on top of it. And it's funny because we expected AR to be the outside facing, right? Like everyone's like, oh, iOS 12 is going to be like, oh, fully AR OS. Turns out it's all where everything is inward facing. It's everything AR to your face, at least for now. I mean, obviously there's... there's that. That's an interesting, like, wrong prediction, I think, that we all made.
I think these sensors are expensive.
Yeah, but I think the sensors will drop in price, and particularly when the developers will get hands on them, the market will create cheaper sensors, will be more available, more will rely on them, and you will basically at some point have no choice but to get them. But you mentioned privacy at some point, and I tried this demo 1.5 months ago at Max Planck Institute in Tübingen here in Germany, where they basically have like 30 or 60 cameras that they film you while you're jumping and moving around on this platform. And then the algorithm not only generates out of this 2 terabytes per minute data stream your photogrammetry and your 3D model, but it can actually remove the clothes from your body. And it can only not remove the clothes from your body because there's a model of your body, but it can change your body in a way that you suddenly have more or a bigger belly or a smaller belly, more muscles, you're higher and lower, and it looks totally natural because it can even make those tiny movements of your skin and the little fat you have under it when you're swinging your arms, right, adjust in the right way. And I think when we have those sensors in every device and you're basically walking around, someone could hijack your system and basically apply the same algorithms they are developing right now that are still very computational heavy. And at some point, you know, from the 3D scan, and you mentioned, you know, women are sometimes a little bit hesitating doing it, right? And also men, they can basically create a 3D structure of your body without the clothes on and actually put you in a 3D porn. So we have right now this case where people are using deepfake algorithms as like a huge issue, where people are projecting faces into a video of a pornography from a celebrity, and it's like a huge scandal and it's like terrible. Okay, but I think this is the final form of it. I think at some point you might even basically substitute people in a movie or render them very realistically into a way, and then suddenly you can show someone, oh, here's a guy who robbed me, you just walked here, and just completely fake because you recreated this whole video. So it might also have a certain danger towards it, right?
Yeah, I think in general, especially these video manipulation technologies will at another level of disabling like the masses of knowing the difference between what's real and what's fake, especially with news. And because we still think that photos are easily manipulated. I think that's a thing that is, that has now been accepted. Like, we all know that every photo of a person in a magazine has been photoshopped. Yes. Because we can do it ourselves on our iPhone, so we know how it works. But very few people know that the exact same stuff is possible on video sources. And the next step is that it's now also possible to do it on video in real time. So you can do it with live news feeds, manipulate them in real time, or maybe with a few seconds of offset, and do the same things that you would do on a magazine.
Look, the iPhone is doing your face into a pig, right? Or into a poo emoji. But who prevents the iPhone from doing this with a model of a real human face, right? I mean, it models the face anyway, so you could technically do it instantly real time, similar as you would do with the Animoji, with just a real face. And basically Broadstream is the face of Obama, or Broadstream is the face of Putin, into a television and saying, okay, I will now, you know, stop, whatever, basically announce something, it will totally look realistic, right? So how can we trust reality?
And nobody knows what's real anymore.
Yeah. How can we?
All right. Well, I'm gonna offer a counterpoint to this, and to show that humans aren't the worst thing in the world. Yes, we are essentially somewhat evolved monkeys, but we always go back down to the most monkey thing ever, which is like sex and, you know, satisfying those needs. And of course, the first implementation of what fake deep fakes get used for is for porn. That makes sense. We're monkeys, whatever. However, people, like, in general, I think use technology beyond porn to make so much more culturally relevant content. And then now at this point, they have now been expressed in the forms of memes. And memes are a huge, huge factor in our culture. And what the other thing that, you know, it got deepfakes got popular for is for putting Nicolas Cage into every movie, into every role.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. Yeah. And guess what? Those are the implementations that like end up becoming the most relevant and most well-known. And of course, we will hear about the porn applications and, like, you know, be outraged by those as well. But like, there with these technologies, there's so much that happens when they're released out into the consumer public, and people are creative for whatever reasons, right? They want to be famous, they want to make something interesting, or they want to make porn.
And let's talk over episode with us.
Anyway,
let's actually mention the episode recorded with Assad and Azad.
Oh, Assad.
Yeah, it's a strange name for an episode, but it kind of also uses 3D scanning technology, right, for our purposes.
Yeah, he's referring to, like, two episodes ago, we had a AR filmmaker on the podcast talking about doing volumetric video captures of certain people and how an interactive film happens in augmented reality. Yeah. And yeah, we talked about this a little bit there. But anyway, guys, we're running low on time. Let's wrap this up. Nick, how can people find you? How can people find your blog? And if they want to contact you about any of these things that we talked about, how can they do that?
It is 3D scan expert on anything. So it's either 3dscanexpert.com or at 3dscanexpert. So awesome. I managed to claim it everywhere.
Ooh.
So just Google it.
Awesome. And for everyone listening, if you want to find the Research VR podcast, you can find us on Twitter at Research VR Cast. You can find us on Facebook at Research VR Podcast. Oh, you also, if you like listening to this podcast and you want to give back a little bit, because we've been doing this all with no ads, with no sponsors for the past like two and a half years, you can please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could find it by either Googling Research VR Podcast or actually all of these links will be in the description as well. I want to give shout outs actually to our Patreons. Give me a second pulling up their names. For the people that have actually supported us already, we are up to 10 patrons already. I think we've been out for about a week. Okay, I got it. And I want to thank our patrons, Hector Mondragon, Hypno Zero, Jesse Benson, Ken Harper, Mark Gillis, Nima Caspian, Nicole Aptekar, One Third Blue, that's you, Angela, and RBS and Rob K. Thank you all so much for supporting us on Patreon. I will keep, I don't know if we'll be doing new lists of patrons every week. I don't know if we're getting that many patrons every week, but if you become a patron, you will be mentioned on the podcast and you will be thanked personally by both of us. Thank you all for supporting us. If you haven't already, join us on Discord, the community where we actually have real-time discussions about these episodes. Sometimes before the guest comes on or afterwards, we have a lot of the episode discussions in there. And Nick, we invite you as well if you want to join a group of VR developers, academics, researchers, and also just enthusiasts. That's where we are. We're almost at 100 people on Discord, actually. It's pretty good. Yeah. We grew pretty quickly. So yes, thank you all again for listening. Thank you, Nick, for joining us.
You're welcome.
This has been a really great episode.
Thanks for having me again.